inviting me, and thank you for the absolutely lovely exhibition that you put together here in the next few days. Of all the wonderful things that are gathered together in this exhibition, there is one, I think, that communicates everything I would like to say this evening in just four words, which I think is a good start. And it's the folio edition, which is just over there, of Bunyan's writings, prepared by his friend Charles Doe in 1692. Reviewing the success of Bunyan's greatest work, Doe says quite simply, the author became famous. Indeed, he did, and Bunyan's fame went much further than Doe was in a position to realise at the time. In the coming centuries, the two parts of the Pilgrim's Progress turned Bunyan from a rather obscure mechanic preacher in Bedfordshire into a figure of global fame. So my talk this evening will be in three parts. First of all, images of Bunyan. Secondly, the folio itself. And thirdly, what might be called Bunyan Victoriana. And so to begin with Bunyan's portraits. If there was someone who had at least some reason to be grateful for the 1670s, it was undoubtedly John Bunyan. He began the decade in prison as a nonconformist preacher and then was appointed to lead the Bedford Church. But despite being admired as a preacher and feared as a controversialist, his renown probably went no further than a limited circle of dissenters. In 1678, however, everything was about to change. In February, Nathaniel Ponder issued the first part of the Pilgrim's Progress, and no less than five editions appeared within under 2 years. Ponder was soon able to boast that the volume, I quote, had sold several impressions and with good acceptation among the people. What you see here is a fairly rare Victorian depiction of Nathaniel Ponder's shop at the sign of the Peacock in the Portree. You see customers, men, women, children, dogs, crowding to buy the Pilgrim's Progress, which by this stage was already a real bestseller. From the third 1679 edition onwards, Nathaniel Ponder included what he calls the author's picture before the title. This was actually more than an ornament. It was one way to distinguish Ponder's own copies from the pirated editions that had just begun to circulate. So almost at the very beginning of Bunyan's fame, his image was an important and potentially contentious issue. It remained important for centuries. The Victorian era, for example, released what can only be described as an attic of Bunyan memorabilia, including busts, medallions, statues, prints and facsimiles, and I will return to this later. This is one example of a bust by E.W. Wynne that I actually almost bought a few years ago, but in the end I decided against it. No Victorian admirer of Bunyan would have supposed that this was a 17th century sculpture. And yet the desire to see an authentic image of Bunyan registered constantly in the 19th century and indeed in the 20th century. There have been many claims that Bunyan was represented and painted in his lifetime, and many claims that contemporary portraits were in circulation. I found some of them mentioned in the amazing late Victorian and Edwardian scrapbook of one George Potter of Highgate, now in the British Library, who gathered a most impressive array of Bunyan relics. There is, for instance, the anonymous so-called Plimpton portrait, supposedly executed in 1673. and of course the Regent's Park portraits, sometimes claim from the 17th century, but actually it has to be said, I think, of uncertain date, and perhaps you can tell me more about this particular portrait, and I'm sure you know more about it than I do. There are many more which are known only from passing references, and here I quote from Victorian newspapers and prints. A painting in the possession of John Fenwick, Esquire, probably actually the Regent's Park portrait, one belonging to George Phillips, Esquire, and an original painting by John Fountain. There was also a portrait in the possession of Mr. John Biggory of Hitchin, and I quote, an original portrait painted in the year 1665 by Mr. Edward Costwald. Throughout the 20th century, various people claimed to possess contemporary portraits of John Bunyan. One was advertised in the Times of 1909 as a very interesting contemporary portrait painted by J.K. 100 guineas. In 1937, there was an advertisement for a 17th century portrait in allegorical style in oils on copper, half length, seated at a table. Perhaps most intriguing of all, in 1932, there appeared in the author's native town of Bedford two small sketches inscribed Mr. and Mrs. Bunyan, fake it, anno 1675. So you begin to see the craze for contemporary representations of Bunyan, an original portrait, a contemporary portrait, a 17th century portrait, and some more precisely dated 1665 or 1675. At present, however, one can only say that there are just three 17th century images that appeared during Bunyan's lifetime. There is a sketch that the engraver Robert White drew from life, and this was left to the British Museum in 1799. A second one you've seen before, the frontispiece, which Bunyan's publisher Ponder calls the author's picture, and which is known for obvious reasons as the sleeping portrait, and this was based upon the previous sketch. The third is the saddler oil portrait, executed around 1685, acquired by the National Portrait Gallery in 1902. Of the three, it was White's sleeping portrait that was to be many times drawn, redrawn, and imitated by so many artists, some of them unskilled, that it rapidly lost its original quality, almost to the point of caricature. This is a version from 1757 and another from 1789, and I leave you to appreciate the difference. It's therefore hardly surprising that what began as Ponder's picture of the author did not fare too well with the critics. In 1830, Bernard Barton offered these reflections upon the degraded versions of White's image. The dull, unmeaning visage, which was wont to stand for his pilgrim's frontispiece, its ponderous skull propped gracelessly on an enormous hand, a countenance one vainly might have scanned for one bright ray of genius or of sense. Because so many of these derivatives were of such poor quality, we need to get back, I think, to the significance of the sharp details and allegorical complexity of White's original frontispiece from the 1670s. That image has a fascinating history whose full context has only recently come to light, and the story begins with Robert White's sketch. I found that reproductions like this one conceal a vital feature of the original. The sketch preserved in the print room of the British Museum shows that White intended the head and shoulders to appear within an oval frame, that he did clearly trace on the vellum with a metal point. This means that the frontispiece for the Pilgrim's Progress was originally intended to look like this. This is actually one of the frontispieces for the Holy War that was published in 1682 between the two parts of the Pilgrim's Progress. Another example, which is actually from the folio, which is in this exhibition, again, an oval rendering of Bunyan here, engraved by John Sturt. So something must have happened for the allegorical frontispiece of the Pilgrim's Progress to look in the end so different. And we don't know exactly what it was. Perhaps Bunyan insisted on an image that revealed more about his allegory. Perhaps Ponder thought that something more intriguing was required. Perhaps White himself read the book and realised that it was not quite right at this stage to place Bunyan within the conventional oval frame that encases so many lords and divines. There are, I think, at least two concomitant traditions that inspired White, or one of his pupils, for the sleeping portrait. To have the hand supporting the head, like here, is part of the traditional iconography of the dreamer and dream interpreter. In biblical illustrations, for instance, we see it used for the guards sleeping as Christ ascends from the tomb, Joseph's dream, Daniel in the lion's den, and Jacob. So here, just one instance, you see a sculpture of Daniel resting his head on his hand, and here you have the dreamer sitting upright, holding his cheek, flanked by a lion, as in the sleeping portrait. And let me show you a couple of pictures of Jacob. This is a 15th century woodcut, and this very interesting one here, which is a 17th century Flemish tapestry, which is now in the Museum of Bern in Burgundy, and was kindly passed on to me by a friend a few years ago. Again, the dreamer, like Bunyan, is not lying down, but sitting. And again, his hand supporting his cheek. And there are, as you can tell, narrative elements all around. So I would therefore suggest that Bunyan is often placed in the position of biblical dreamers and prophets, so that the allegory derives authority from that pictorial tradition. But there is another tradition to take into account here, the imagery of the melancholic meditating on the vanity of life, as, for instance, in the representation of John Evelyn by Robert Baker in 1648. The hand resting on the head, and perhaps the long hair as well, suggests the melancholic temperament of the author, and in some version of the sleeping portrait, there appears a skull too, linking Bunyan to the same pictorial tradition. My second section is now devoted more precisely to the publication of Bunyan's works in folio. Again, you can see one very fine example at the back here. The folio format was traditionally reserved for the works of eminent divines, and certainly not of tinkers. The Bunyan folio was published in 1692 with the subscriptions of some 400 patrons, 30 of whom ministers. The book cost 10 shillings unbound, 12 shillings bound. And it will not surprise you to hear that it costs rather more than that today. Originally advertised for publication in February, it was in fact issued a little bit later in the autumn, and also, although it was meant to be published in two volumes, the second one never appeared. There are 22 of Bunyan's theological works in the book, 10 of which had been published before, and 12 more printed from original manuscripts. As you can see from this list, there is none of Bunyan's fiction, and therefore no copy of The Pilgrim's Progress. this very big, thick volume is introduced by John Sturt's oval engraved portrait that you've seen before, together with a eulogy of the author by two ministers, Ebenezer Chandler, Bunyan's successor in Bedford, and John Wilson from Hitching. The book closes with an elaborate index, a complete catalogue of Bunyan's works, a list of no less than 30 reasons why readers should buy the book, and a concluding piece entitled The Struggler. In this last item, Charles Doe, the editor, says how he struggled over the publication of the folio in words that echo his description of Bunyan as struggling with himself and with others. Not much is known about Charles Doe except what he says himself in a short autobiography published in 1700. He was born around 1653. He was a layman and a maker of combs by trade, married to the daughter of an ex-parliamentary captain. In 1686, he began selling religious books at the sign of the Boar's Head in Southwark, situated between London Bridge and St. Thomas's Hospital. In 1682, Doe was baptised in a general Baptist church that met in Paul's Alley in the Barbican, led by Thomas Plant. This was an area with a strong dissenting tradition, close to Coleman Street and the Great Dissenters Cemetery, Burnhill Fields, where Bunyan lies almost shoulder to shoulder with William Blake, Daniel Defoe, and the father of John Keats. Around 1684, Doe became associated with another congregation that he nevertheless didn't formally join, the congregation of Stephen Moore, this time a particular, that is, Calvinistic Baptist church, situated much closer to Doe's trading place, south of the river, near the great church of St. Mary Overy, which is today Southwark Cathedral, shaken many times every hour by the trains that rattle across Waterloo Bridge. Moore's congregation was open communion, like that of Bunyan, and it was there that Doe heard Bunyan preach for the first time in 1685. Little else is known about Charles Doe, but I recently made a chance discovery in the Angus Library and Archive, which takes us a little further. While working on another project, I discovered that Doe is mentioned in the church book of the Baptist Church in London, meeting in Maze Pond. On the 2nd of July 1695, Doe asked for admission on the grounds that his former congregation had introduced the singing of hymns on Sundays, and Charles Doe refused to sing. Brother Charles Doe, formerly a member with the people that were plants, being dissatisfied with their new brought-in singing, etc., proposed to join in communion with this church. The church was satisfied in the cause of his separation. And I even stumbled across Charles Doe's signature, for it appears in the register of members. So, why are the Regent's Park copies of the Bunyan Folio so special? First of all, as this exhibition makes clear, because you have a chained copy. A portion of the chain is still attached to the book, and a flyleaf note bearing the name of Philip Farmer describes how the book was to be used in its original home. This book was given by Philip Farmer to the Church of Christ meeting at their meeting house in Westbrook at Farringdon, constituted of such only as are baptised upon profession of their faith, to abide fixed in their meeting house for the use of all such, whether members or hearers, as shall resort thither at convenient seasons to read in it or hear any part of it read, never to be moved from their present meeting house, so long as they or they successors of the same faith and order shall possess and use the same for their meeting house. And if ever that church so constituted shall remove to another meeting place or be divided, it is the will of the donor that the greatest number of such members as aforesaid that shall hold together shall possess and enjoy this book for common use as aforesaid. This is declared by the donor of the first day of February, Anno Domini 1711. This is a unique document describing how the Bunyan Folio was to be permanently kept in the meeting house for all those wishing to read it or to hear it read when stepping into the building. And incidentally, the volume was restored in 1888, which is not just any date, but the bi-anniversary of Bunyan's death in 1688. This is not the only copy in Regent's Park to display original features. There are also two copies where the index has a separate title page, which does not feature elsewhere. Why is this important? Because it reminds us that the folio was intended to serve as a practical tool for ministers and their churches. Doe devotes a considerable amount of space to the usefulness of the index that encompasses important theological notions, controversies, cases of conscience, and instructions how to minister in a church. But it offers even more than that. Doe turns it into a compilation of types, metaphors, and similes for ministers to peruse when composing their own sermons. It is a treasure house of beasts, gems, plants, elements, and astronomical notions, of legendary creatures and biblical places, of crystal, glass, gold, stones, fruit, seeds, and sticks, of rivers and wildernesses, cities, gates, streets, walls, etc. The importance of the index to Doe's view of the folio is clear from the two copies in Regent's Park. You've got it here. This index is presented to Mr. of Inn by Charles Doe and William Marshall because of his goodwill in subscribing to the printing of this folio 1691. So evidently the gaps were left so that a name, town and county could be inserted, and this is the case here with one Mr. John Carter. This tells us that Doe intended that some copies of the index, but not all of them, should be sent perhaps to his most eminent patrons as a particular mark of esteem. Without the Regent's Park copies, this strategy may never have come to light. Doe took pride in compiling writings and tables that could serve as an invaluable tool for ministers and spread wide the seeds of Bunyan's wisdom. No doubt he was very gratified that some churches subscribed to the folio, such as Bristol and Canterbury. Many Baptist churches then bought the folio, and again, we know this thanks to other collections in the Angus Library. For instance, in the 18th century, William Carr, pastor of a church meeting at Hamsterley and called Rowley, recorded that Bunyan's folio was among a small library given to the ministry of our church. The folio then passed on to Carr's successor, Isaac Gardner, who emphasizes the communal ownership of the volume. I received from John Carr of Muggleswick four other books, all which belong to the church, viz. Carroll on Job in two volumes, Bunyan's works in folio, and Wilson's dictionary. Other books belong to the church beside these, viz. A large concordance and Dr. Gill's exposition of the New Testament in three volumes. My third and last section is devoted to what might be called Bunyan's Victoriana. And I'm hastening to say I'm no specialist of that period, but I really couldn't leave it. To explore the Bunyan tradition is to encounter centuries of accumulated legend, polemic, and prejudices that began to spread even during his lifetime. Bunyan was accused of being a witch, a highwayman, a Jesuit, a gypsy, and a whoremaster. Some even said he had murdered the father of Agnes Beaumont, falsely charged with being his mistress. In the 18th century, there were titles that readers acquired with even greater avidity than Bunyan's genuine works, for they were all spurious. The third part of The Pilgrim's Progress, a copy is here in the exhibition, but also a dialogue between a blind man and death, meditations on the several ages of man's life, scriptural poems, a race for eternal life, rest for a wearied soul, the riches of Christ, and one example here, the visions of John Bunyan. So the 18th century produced a conflict between the canonical Bunyan of the expensive collected works and the bogus Bunyan of the cheaper prints, writer of doggerel visions and meditations. In the 19th century, as Bunyan's fame grew, this became even more obvious. In November 1817, for instance, Ladies' Monthly Museum, a periodical, informed its reader that, I quote, "The celebrated John Bunyan, author of The Pilgrim's Progress, at one period of his life kept a public house in the neighbourhood of Turvey in Bedfordshire, and perhaps in commemoration of the profession of his father and his own in his youth, put up the sign of the Tinker of Turvey." Unlikely, mind you, but not entirely impossible, but let's say unlikely. This was also the time when The Pilgrim's Progress achieved worldwide fame. Ships left the port of London for the British imperial colonies, freighted with as many copies of The Pilgrim's Progress as the Bible. The pictures in the many illustrated editions shaped the imagination of generations, as revealed by works as diverse as Dickens' The Old Curiosity Shop, George Eliot's The Mill on the Floss, and M.R. James' O Whistle and I Come to You, My Lad, where the frightened narrator ponders the description of Apollyon coming over the field to meet Christian in The Pilgrim's Progress, a passage, I quote James, which catches most people's fancy at some point of their childhood. Despite such horrors, the most devout or diligent pupils in Victorian Sunday schools were rewarded with copies of The Pilgrim's Progress, whence the many 19th century editions now to be found in second-hand bookshops with florid and gilded book plates announcing first prize for scripture knowledge, or like here, prize for regular attendance. Many were family gifts and are sometimes supplied with manuscript admonitions from the giver, such as mark, read, and inwardly digest. George Eliot's account of Maggie Tulliver in The Mill on the Floss suggests that the attraction for many young devotees lay mostly in the adventures of the pilgrims rather than in the teachings, not to mention the opportunity to colour the line drawings. There were also editions of The Pilgrim's Progress in words of one syllable. This is the insight. It's a little bit difficult to translate Evangelist of Christian in only one syllable, but apart from that, they actually did quite a good job, I think. Bunyan's great work of fiction was also read aloud as part of the great Victorian effort to educate the lower classes. In 1862, Archdeacon Jones from Liverpool recalled that he had, I quote, read The Pilgrim's Progress publicly with a running commentary to a large Sunday evening congregation. The assembly listening to the recital with, I quote again, fixed attention and deep interest. Perhaps the highest point of Bunyan's fame was the unveiling of a Byrne statue in St. Peter's Green, Bedford, in 1874, which celebrated Bunyan as a national treasure. If no readers celebrated Bunyan's life and works better than the Victorians, no Victorian embodied this better than George Offa, who died in 1864 and was buried not far from Bunyan in Burnhill Fields. Offa was a critic and patron of the arts who published Bunyan's works in the 1850s, an edition not superseded until the Oxford Bunyan was completed in 1994. An avid collector, Offa claimed to possess, in addition to copy of Bunyan's works by the thousand, an iron pen case made by the author, his buckles, two pocket knives, his apple scoop, a seal, and his box of scales and weights, all of which were lost in the fire that destroyed Sotheby's auction rooms prior to the sale of Offa's collection in June 1865. Not everything disappeared in that blaze, however, and here, exhibit 22 in the exhibition is one charred survivor. The Bunyan Museum in Bedford remains a true cabinet de curiosité for all Bunyan enthusiasts, showing how devotedly relics of Bunyan have been treasured up, or perhaps, as is often the case with relics, manufactured. There one may see Bunyan's pulpit, his chair, his flute, supposedly cut from the leg of a chair while in prison, and the jug that was used to carry broth to him in prison, or his Sunday dinner in the meeting house, according to a different account. There is also a chest adorned with representations of musical instruments. All these rub shoulders with copies of the Pilgrim's Progress translated into hundreds of languages in the course of three centuries, and their astonishing variety lends itself easily to photographic montage. You've got one here that I got from the leaflet of this exhibition with different edition, one in Chinese, and this is the ones for my copies at home that we use for the International John Bunyan Society. Compared to Bunyan, who's associated with so many varied mementos in addition to his fiction, Shakespeare seems almost to have vanished from the earth without trace. As this hoard of memorabilia suggests, Bunyan was ubiquitous in 19th century culture. A china trade was named after him. Stained glass windows, wallpapers, magic lantern slides, panoramas, picture puzzles, and board games depicted characters and scenes from his works and had a special appeal for children. And let me show you a few examples. This is a wallpaper from the last quarter of the 19th century supplied by F. Scott and Son, shown at the Victoria and Albert Museum. An American board game produced by the McLaughlin brothers in 1883. And this is the inside of the game going from the City of Destruction to the Celestial City. And I want to show you three slides from a surviving magic lantern in the Bill Douglas collection at the University of Exeter, showing, first of all, the fight with Apollyon, just afterwards the hand of God healing Christian after the fight, and a quite striking Vanity Fair. And finally, two, I think, rather extraordinary plates out of 33 that were recently acquired by the Cinémathèque in Paris. They're exceptional in their craftsmanship, hand-painted in the mid-19th century by the painter Thomas Clare. I think it's quite lovely. This is the beginning of the book with Bunyan still with his hand, his cheek resting on his hand in the prison. Here's a jug. And he's got a copy here of the Bible and of Fox's book, Earth Martyrs. And this rather striking second slide from an episode from The Pilgrim's Progress, and you've got Christian here falling asleep in the arbor and losing his precious roll. And for those of you who think that the process of generating fresh images of Bunyan is over, let me remind you that the video game of The Pilgrim's Progress is still available for £1.99. You will be able to experience another kind of a Vanity Fair and download The Pilgrim's Progress Strategy Guide. Over the years, Bunyan enthusiasts and collectors formed a formidable network of correspondence through the pages of notes and queries and advertisements in the Times. This interest did not subside in the early 20th century. British soldiers in the trenches of 1914 to 18 used material from The Pilgrim's Progress, notably the Slough of Despond and the Valley of the Shadow of Death, to express the inexpressible in letters and other writings which reveal the importance of the book to an entire generation on the verge of both modernism and their own city of destruction. And just to conclude, what does all this tell us? Through a few examples, the portraits of John Bunyan, the publication of his works in folio, the richness of material culture and artifacts, and the spreading of legends in Victorian England, we have seen many aspects of the author of The Pilgrim's Progress, how he was invented by friends and editors, admirers, writers, missionaries, and manufacturers, both inside and outside the dissenting tradition, and both in popular and elite cultures. He still is, even though the fame of The Pilgrim's Progress seems to have waned, sometimes probably after the 1950s. And let's not forget that Bunyan's fiction appeared at regular intervals for only 8 years and does not represent a major proportion of his work. Of the 58 writings that form the Bunyan canon as it is received today, 5 are larger works of fiction and 7 are verse collections, leaving 46 non-fiction writings. Bunyan produced extended sermons, a conduct book, a catechism, a map of salvation, a versified church order, various pamphlets directed against the Quakers and the Church of England, works of practical or pastoral theology, and a series of epistles. To sample these writings in all their diversity is to find dreams, allegories, exemplar, poems, letters, emblems, dialogues, and much more. What the current exhibition shows us is not only Bunyan's text, but how these texts survived and were transmitted to posterity. A chained folio, a charred copy of The Pilgrim's Progress, illustrated editions, imitations, and spurious versions. I have also drawn your attention to other archival material here in the Angus Library and Archive that allow us to understand Bunyan better in the context of 17th century churches. To complement these beautiful and unique objects, I hope I have shown you how diverse and enduring the invention of John Bunyan has proven to be throughout the centuries, and hopefully given you an appetite for more. Thank you very much.